Namo Buddhaya. So we're going to be looking at this theme of transforming self and world from two different directions, and you can probably imagine what those directions might be. Self and world. And I'm here to talk a bit about the first of those, transforming self. Transforming self, but you can't really transform self without transforming the world around you. And you can't transform the world around you or engage with that without transforming yourself. So they are intimately linked, but you can start from different directions. And last year, when we did the urban retreat last year, we focused quite a bit on the life of one particular of our teachers, Sangharakshita is on the shrine, but his teacher, Dado Rinpoche, was one of the, well, the focus. And he was a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who Sangharakshita reckoned was, as far as he was concerned, an example of a living bodhisattva, a bodhisattva being one who's dedicated his or her life to the benefit of all beings. We watched a video about Dado Rinpoche, about him talking about his life, about his day, about what he did. He spent all day virtually, you know, working within, he founded and ran a Tibetan school for children, and taught whoever came. That was his whole day, was basically working for the sake of others. Except that he also got up at 4 a.m. and while he was brushing his teeth, he was visualizing one particular bodhisattva while he was, you know, he would start at 4 a.m. and practice for 4 hours before then spending the rest of the day. And it seems to me those two are linked. He was able to spend his whole day devoting himself to the benefit of other people because he spent 4 hours in the morning devoting himself to his own benefit or the benefit of transforming his own mind. So these are linked. And in order to cultivate this kind of bodhisattva spirit, we also need to cultivate our own minds. Now, 4 hours a day, I know, is asking a lot. but something every day is worth committing to. It's what gives us the motivation. It's what gives us the robustness. It's what gives us the sort of fertile mind or ability to respond. So this is why we're looking at transforming self. But we're looking at it from also from a particular angle. There's a book which is a kind of, you know, for this particular part of the theme. This book, Sangharakshita, Ritual and Devotion in Buddhism, is, you know, if you want to buy this book, I think we have copies in the bookshop, or you can order them. This is, in a way, the sort of theme book for this part of the theme. Because we're going to be looking at the puja, the sevenfold puja, and it's in its stages. Now, I'd just actually like to start by these words, ritual and devotion. I'd just like to get a sense of what responses do you have to those words immediately? You know, just say it. Positive, negative, neutral, ritual and devotion.
Negative.
Because of your upbringing,
yeah.
Which was
Catholic.
Yes. Thank you, Linga. Yeah. Well, you don't have to say positive, negative, or neutral. You can use other words as well.
Yeah.
What comes to your mind with those?
Yeah, well, negative as well.
Yeah.
From a Catholic family as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
Variable.
Yeah. Variable.
Sometimes wonderful.
Sometimes it doesn't do it. Yes. Ambivalence. Yes.
I started off very wary, but actually letting go, yeah, has opened up a huge vista which I never knew or never anticipated would happen.
Yeah.
Nothing can be uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
Can be.
Can be uncomfortable.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mostly uncomfortable.
Mostly uncomfortable.
I find it quite expensive.
Expansive.
Very uplifting.
Uplifting.
At first I found it alienating.
Alienating.
I have found it inspiring. But
and now
inspiring.
Yeah. Sure.
Quite strange.
Strange.
Yeah, especially ritual.
Yes.
More than devotion,
funny
enough.
Yes. Ritual. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I like ritual.
Yes.
I think it acts on parts of the mind where logic doesn't reach.
Yes. That's true. Yes.
And devotion, I'm not too sure what it means.
Okay. Okay. Maybe, you know, that will become clearer as we're talking about it. Yes. It's interesting that there's not a lot of neutrality going on here, is there? there's the uncomfortable, you know, the negative response, and then sometimes a very positive response as well. There's not a lot of the... Well, maybe some of you do feel lukewarm and neutral towards ritual. Just haven't said...
Maybe less easy to say so.
Yes, less easy to say a neutral response. Yeah. Anyway, so so we're going to be exploring this theme through the puja, through the stages of the puja, and we're going to give time to each stage, because I think one of the things to do is to familiarise ourselves or become more, you know, to get to understand what the stages are, what their significance is. So that's what we're going to be doing. And I must say, you know, it's interesting to hear the responses, because I think we do bring quite a lot of previous conditioning to ritual in Buddhism. Obviously, we've had conditionings maybe to do with other religious backgrounds, where ritual is a lot to do with maybe guilt. I remember I was brought up in a Protestant tradition, and there weren't very many rituals in that, but there was communion, where you were eating the body and drinking the blood of Christ, which I found fairly disgusting as an idea. I never grew up, you know, I didn't ever participate in that, but that was a ritual, but it has, you know, it has an emotional impact. So there may be those sorts of associations with rituals that maybe feel uncomfortable or alienating. There may also be associated with rituals which have just become somewhat hollow or meaningless because you don't actually believe in the values behind them. And so I think I remember school assembly, when I stopped believing in God, just became a rather meaningless ritual for me. So that's I think that's the sort of element of alienation that can happen. So yeah, these are our responses, and we need to acknowledge that they're there. You know, we don't have to like ritual because it's one of the practices we do. It's a question of getting to know ourselves in relation to them. But I do want to sort of suggest that ritual is actually all around us. Ritual is part of everyday life. I mean, there's the bigger rituals. If you think of rituals that surround Christmas, think of the colours that are involved with Christmas. Think of the red of the forest. Oh, sorry, the green of the forest, and the red of berries, the red of fire. Think of the darkest time of the year when we create light. We have fairy lights and candles and all of that kind of thing. It's as if we have a kind of real human need in that darkest time of the year to sort of connect with light and connect with those kind of very primeval colours as well. It comes out of our connection with the natural world, and with the seasons. Think of Easter with eggs. don't know what chocolate's got to do with it. Maybe it's in there somewhere. Revival, you know, springtime, flowers, buddies. they are part of our kind of connection with the natural world and the seasons, these rituals. And human rituals too. I think, you know, when you invite or somebody arrives in your house, what do you do?
Offer them a cup of tea.
You offer them a cup of tea. Is it because they're thirsty? Or you offer them a drink, usually. And you usually accept a cup of tea, whether or not you're thirsty. There's a sort of, it's like an offering, you know, somebody's arrived in your space, you want to give them something. And also think, what's the thing that you give? It's liquid. It's something fluid. And in the sort of symbolism of the different elements, liquid is often to do with emotion, fluidity, exchange. So when you're offering somebody a hot drink or even a cold drink, you're offering a sort of a connection. You're both drinking some fluid together. And so it's a ritual, really. It's a ritual. There's lots of these rituals around, which we perform in all sorts of ways, consciously or unconsciously. If you start to actually look at a lot of our behaviour, there's ritual involved. You meet somebody, you don't immediately start talking about the most important, in-depth, you know, kind of issue that's going on in your life. Or, well, maybe you do, but usually you start by exchanging a bit of, you know, lighter communication to make each other feel at ease and find out how one each other are, you know, that sort of thing. It's a bit of a ritual exchange. I want to just very do a little ritual right now. It's very, very simple. I want you to find a partner. It's going to be very simple. Don't worry about this. The person sitting next to you. And what I want you to do is just face one another. And one of you make eye contact and bow to the other person. And then the other person make eye contact and bow back. That's all. So, bowing the hands down. Okay, you're done. Only takes a moment. What did that feel like?
Connecting.
Warm. Did it feel different bowing or being bowed to?
Yes.
In what way?
I really enjoy bowing.
Yes.
It came natural. When I was about to, I kind of thought, oh my goodness.
Yes.
I liked it, but at the same time, it was so strange. Yes.
Exactly. It's odd, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It wasn't formulated like that, but it was something strange that wasn't in my bowing.
Yes.
Yes.
Odd, isn't it? It's odd. And I think all that demonstrates, what that demonstrates is that ritual, even a simple ritual like that, has a sort of sudden emotional impact, one way or the other. You know, you immediately feel something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Felt like giving and receiving.
Giving and receiving, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was quite straight. I really enjoyed the eye contact, mm-hmm. And when the bowing happened, I sort of felt I lost it.
Lost the contact at that point. Yes. It was one of the things I noticed when I visited India. Is that's the common greeting, is to bow to one another rather than shake hands or whatever. It's actually lovely. A sort of kind of sense of a mutual respect, you know, just acknowledgement. Yeah. So, ritual, yeah. It is very much a part of traditional Buddhism. In fact, in some ways, it's much more basic part of traditional Buddhism than meditation. If you're in Thailand or with Tibetan Buddhists, you'll find that the primary practice that they engage with is making offerings, is maybe chanting some verses, is you know, chanting ritual, that kind of thing. Yes, and so this is interesting because it's not necessarily the way we engage with Buddhism in the West so much. We tend to start with meditation and gradually kind of get more familiar with ritual. I mean, we do, for example, always chant the refuges and precepts at the start of a Saturday morning, which is, of course, a ritual chanting. But sometimes it can be that it's our first way in is through meditation. Some while ago, I remember watching a film which showed a Tibetan puja, which had the subtitles, you know, the translation of what was being chanted. This was a very long film. It went on for about 3 hours. And I sat there and watched this. I can't say it engaged my interest all the way through, but something that really, really struck me as I was watching the ritual, which was very, very elaborate, with a lot of hand movements, mudras, offerings, music, drums, and chanting. And the words were just very, very, very repetitive. And what they were saying over and over again was, oh, I'm getting quite moved just from that. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. May this offering be for the benefit of all beings. May this other offering, may this chant, may the, you know, over and over and over, 3 hours, you know. And, you know, if you just kind of let go and let this kind of really sink in, you realise that this ritual must have a very, very profound impact on minds and consciousness, to be cultivating that wish over and over and over and over again. Because this is one of the features of ritual, it is actually repetitive. We do the same rituals. That's partly what makes them rituals. The same words. And in some ways, I remember I used to feel quite resistant to this. I'd want a bit of novelty, you know. Sevenfold puja. Do something different, you know, or whatever. But there is something about this repetition, again, that goes in and creates a sort of, well, let's say positive condition response. It's a sort of steeping oneself in aspiration. Yeah. I just remember that on one retreat I was on it was quite a long retreat, and we were doing a particular puja, not the sevenfold puja, but a particular puja every night, a puja called the Sutra of Golden Light Puja. And it's very long, and it would tend to happen at the end of the day, and I'd be really tired, and I'd feel this is going to go on forever, you know. And after a few nights of resistance and sort of feeling, I'm just tired, I want this to be over, I remember all of a sudden I heard the words in a new way, and it was as if something cracked open in me. And, I mean, it's called the Sutra of Golden Light. It felt like suddenly being flooded with golden light, and that the words which I was kind of resisting were carrying a meaning that were more than words. It was, you know, it was one of those experiences where I sort of felt like I got it in a certain way. So, yeah. Just a little bit of historical background here. I think going right back to the time of the Buddha, after the Buddha died, his disciples, the particular places where he stayed, in particular was a hut or dwelling in Shravasti, which was called the Gandakuti, or the perfumed chamber. So this was a place where he spent many rainy seasons. He gave many teachings. And after he died, this place continued to be kept as if he was present. It was swept, it was offerings would be brought. So treated as a place of devotion or place of reverence. Now the thing is that it's not that the disciples at that time believed that the Buddha was still there, because they were Buddhists. They knew that all conditioned things come to an end. They'd heard that teaching over and over again. But that place was somehow permeated with a sense of meaning, of significance, of value for them. And being there brought the Buddha to mind. It sort of brought him to life for them in their imagination, in their mind. And in a way, this is the sort of background or the purpose of puja. What we're doing is creating a sense, first of all, of presence, a sense of what would it be like to be with our teacher, the Buddha? What would it be like to be in his presence? We have a shrine which, you know, there's an image of the Buddha. We know that that's not a magic image which somehow is the Buddha, but it calls the Buddha to mind. This one in particular calls to mind an active, a walking Buddha, teaching Buddha, that particular quality of communication. So the image calls the Buddha to mind. It calls forth, I suppose, that quality within ourselves. You know, an image of the Buddha is an image of humanity perfected, humanity grown and developed, our own human qualities developed to the greatest possible extent. And so that's where a puja begins, is with a sense of cultivating, a sense of presence, a sense of contact, however that works for you. So it's sometimes quite good to begin before performing a puja, to just sit with a sense of presence. I think Amara Pushpa mentioned that this morning when she began to lead the meditation, to, you know, just have a sense of presence using the imagination. What would it be like to be in the presence of the Buddha? So the particular Sevenfold Puja that we do derives from a text, a particular book or text by, this is it, the Bodhicharanatara. Some of you may know it, some of you not. It was a teaching given by a Buddhist teacher, 8th century Buddhist teacher called Shantideva. And the story goes that he was in a monastery in Nalanda, and he was reckoned to be a rather lazy monk, and the other monks didn't rate him very highly because he never seemed to be doing anything very much. It was said that he practiced the three realizations, which were eating, sleeping and defecating. You can see that even in a Mahayana monastery there's still unpleasant teasing and gossip going on. Anyway, so in order to sort of show him up, he was invited to give a teaching. So he was invited to give a teaching, and he turned up on the day, and he sat on the throne, whatever, and he began to speak. And this was the teaching that he gave. So the Bodhicharyavatara, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Which is, I do very much recommend reading it, maybe just looking at, you know, taking a few verses. It's a very, very, it's a very Mahayana book. Mahayana is, generally speaking, uses quite poetic language, quite emotional language, often quite extreme language, you know, quite uncompromising language. But it's also very, very beautiful, very, very inspiring. Anyway, it said that when he got to the 9th chapter, which was the perfection of understanding, he began to rise up in the air, float above the throne, and gradually disappear from view, although his voice was still heard continuing teaching. Now, obviously, this is a legend. It's a rather lovely legend. Apparently, he began to rise up in the air at verse 34. I bet you're interested in what it said. Okay, I'll read it to you. I don't think you'll be any the wiser, but this is verse 34, where he says, "Where neither entity nor non-entity remains before the mind, there is no other mode of operation. Grasping no objects, it becomes tranquil." Oh, well, so that's the point at which he began to vanish. And he vanished from the monastery and never came back. He went elsewhere, apparently. He obviously didn't appreciate his quality. So the whole aim of this text is the cultivation of what's called bodhicitta, will to enlightenment. The will to enlightenment, realization of Buddhahood for the sake of all beings, not for just oneself alone. And that's the theme of it. And it's said that there are various traditional means of cultivating bodhicitta, and one of them is performing puja, performing the puja which comes from the Bodhicharivatara, the sevenfold puja. So in a way, this is why, you know, the transforming self and world, this is where the link happens. One of the traditional means is puja, to cultivate this compassionate wish for the benefit of others. And so in a way, we need to sort of get behind the meaning of puja, what the sevenfold puja, what it's about, in order to understand why this is reckoned to be such an effective means of transforming the mind. We have our sevenfold puja, and it begins with the words. It begins with conjuring up flowers as offerings to the Buddha. It begins with the words with mandarava, blue lotus, and jasmine. The very first Buddhist study group I ever participated in, years and years ago, we were studying the sevenfold puja, and we spent the whole first section on with mandarava. We didn't get any further than that. That's why is that? What is mandarava? Mandarava is a flower, but it's not a real flower. It's not a flower that we can see in a garden anywhere in the world. A mandarava is apparently the size of a cartwheel. It's a huge flower. It's golden in colour, and it showers down from the heavens when the Buddha teaches. Presumably it's quite light as well. Just imagining cartwheels. It lightly floats down from the heavens when the Buddha teaches. So mandarava is not a real flower. And what this very first two words of the puja is saying is, we're entering into a different kind of realm. We're entering into a realm of imagination rather than a realm of real flowers, real earthly flowers. I remember that was the whole theme of that very first study group that I was in. That it's a bit like those words are a sort of portal that you step through into a different, an imaginative world. So the puja is somewhere where we are creating an imaginal world, a world where we encounter Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, a world where those archetypal beings are present in our imagination. Now, I don't want to say, actually, I hope I didn't just say, I maybe did just say, not a real world. Because imagination, in a sense, is as real to us, to our inner selves, as the external world is. What we create in our imagination is as real in terms of its impact on us. We create a realm of imaginal beauty. It has an effect on us, just as if we were walking through a garden. So imagination is very important. So I'm going to briefly go through the stages of the Sevenfold Puja, just to, in a way, outline the map and see what they signify. Because, in a way, what they are seven devotional moods or mental states that sort of arise one out of the other. They kind of, you know, there's a kind of inner psychology to them, an inner logic to them. Out of one state, the next one arises. So I'd just like to kind of show the whole map, and then over the next few weeks we'll be looking at each stage in a little more detail. I remember once we did a weekend retreat at Rivendell, which was a puja the whole weekend, simply taking one stage in more depth and detail, and then through the day going, you know, to the next stage and the next stage. It was a lovely weekend, it was a beautiful weekend, and it really could have brought the puja to life in a way that sometimes doesn't, you know, when you're just doing it quite quickly. But it begins with the first stage of the puja, which is worship. And we are incidentally going to recite this at the end, so we'll get to that. This is so cultivating that sense of presence of the Buddha and making offerings. So there are these eight or seven traditional offerings which are offered to the honoured guest in India. I mean, we offer a cup of tea. That's the one traditional offering that we make to the honoured guest. In India, these seven traditional offerings, and these are actually what the seven bowls on the shrine signify. They sort of stand in for these seven traditional offerings, which are, there's flowers, there's incense, there's candles, there's water to drink, water to wash the feet, perfumed water, and food. So if a guest comes to one's house in India, these traditionally would be what would be offered to the guest. So in a sense, what's being said is that the Buddha is being treated as the honoured guest. So the Buddha has been invited into the, you know, our ambience, and these offerings are the offerings that are made. And those are the verses of the first section of the puja are conjuring up these particular offerings. So then we move on. The second stage is what's called salutation. And so this is where it becomes not just a verbal or a mental offering. It talks about bowing. It talks about saluting the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And in fact, previous to that, we usually chant a mantra where you can come forward and bow to the shrine and make offerings. So salutation is in a way involving not only our speech, our mind, but it's also involving our body. In traditional Buddhism, that these are the three aspects that make up a human being, is body, speech, and mind. And so with salutation, the body's engaged as well. It's brought into sort of physical, you know, actually making a salutation, making a bow. And then out of that, so in these first two stages, there's a sort of sense of devotion that's being cultivated. The third stage of the puja is what's called going for refuge. This is where devotion becomes, well, goes deeper and becomes more a sense of resolution or commitment. So in going for refuge stage, what we're stating is that we're turning our life towards the three jewels, to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. There's commitment. We're resolving to orient our lives around those values. So in a sense, it doesn't just stay on the emotional, devotional level. It becomes a volitional, you know, something that's to do with a resolve to practice. So out of that stage, the stage of going for refuge, usually what happens when we commit ourselves to something, the next thing that happens is what we experience. I don't know, anybody got any ideas? After commitment?
Resistance.
Yes. usually after you resolve to do something, even if it's a New Year's resolution or whatever, what arises is what's difficult about that. You know, you've kind of resolved to commit yourself, but then there are forces within yourself that maybe don't want to go along with that. And so the next stage is the stage of confession or disclosure. So we encounter next the parts of us that don't want to grow, the parts of us that don't want to develop. And at that point, what we're aiming to do is disclose them to ourselves and to others, and ritually to the Buddha, to sort of, in a way, let go of them. A confession is a word, obviously, which has a lot of connotations, religious connotations for us, often related to sin and guilt. And obviously, we'll be going into this in a lot more depth when we come to that stage, but really, I just want to say right now, it's got nothing to do with sin and guilt. It's got to do with letting go of our resistance and experiencing the kind of lightness that comes from that. Which naturally then leads on to the next stage, which is rejoicing in merit. And I do want to just tell a story. The very first retreat that I was on was a weekend retreat, and we had a talk on the Sevenfold Puja, which I listened to with great interest and fascination. And when the chap who was giving the talk got to the point of confession, he was talking about confession very, very beautifully, very fully. He was quoting a story from the book Brothers Karamazov. I was very moved by this. And what I thought was going to happen when we went into the puja was that we would all stand up and confess to one another in public. And I was sort of somewhat intrigued and excited by this, but actually when it came to it, I found actually that wasn't what happened. I was a bit relieved as well. So, So rejoicing in merit is the next stage. So out of the sense of having let go of resistance, at least within this context of this puja, a feeling of relief arises and rejoicing. And rejoicing in merit, it's called. So a sense of the value of skillfulness, the value of skillful action, the value of goodness arises. And when our own kind of limitations are kind of set aside, our hearts do open. Our hearts open to our own worth and to the worth of others. So in this stage, what we're doing is giving expression to that, giving expression to the joy that we experience in human goodness. Gladdened, we feel gladdened. So these stages, we've been through these stages, and we come then to a point which is maybe the heart of the puja. It's what's called entreaty and supplication. So we've been cultivating positive states. Hopefully, that's what we've been doing. And at this point, we're receptive, we're open. In a way, we're ready to hear the Buddha teach. We're ready to hear the truth. So at this point, it's not just that we passively wait for that to happen. There's an actual wish that we express that we may hear the teaching, we may hear the Buddha teach, or we may hear the Dharma. Yeah, we ask for it. We ask for the teaching. And often in the puja at this point, there's a reading, a Dharma reading. So in response to that wish, there's a response. But there's also what follows is the Heart Sutra, the sutra which in a way epitomizes the perfection of wisdom, the wisdom of the Buddha. So we repeat that, usually in unison. Well, yes, we repeat that in unison. The rest of the puja usually or often takes place in call and response. But at this point, we say it together. And that means we kind of need to learn it by heart. Which is a very good thing, because it's portable Dharma, isn't it? It's sort of, if you learn something by heart, It's just always there, and the more that you know it, the more it can come to your mind. I tend to find I often repeat the Heart Sutra myself when I'm taking off in an airplane. I do it at other times, but there's something about that particular point where just leaving, you know, could die now, just leaving the ground. This is a good point to say the Heart Sutra. Yeah. But, you know, there are other times too. It's there, and when learning something by heart, or often, that's a nice expression too, isn't it? It sort of goes into your heart. The more you kind of repeat it, it's part of your heart. So we learn the Heart Sutra and we repeat it together. And seventhly, the final stage of the sevenfold puja is giving all this away, just all the merit accrued. As I was describing that Tibetan puja, which was like, whatever we do, we give it away. We give it for the benefit of all. So in this stage, it's that attitude that we're dwelling in, that this may have been a meritorious action to perform, but the merit isn't for me. It's for all beings. It's for the sake of all beings. So this is being given away mentally, you know, mentally doing this. There's a verse from the Bodhicharavatara, from elsewhere in the Bodhicharavatara from the puja, where Shantideva says, "Nirvana is the giving up of all, and it is nirvana that my heart yearns for. If I am to give up everything, then let me give it to beings." In a sense, it's a kind of connecting with the wisdom that actually we don't own anything. We don't even own ourselves. You know, what we're aiming to do through our Dharma practice is let go of self-clinging, let go of that, you know, kind of continual concern, you know, limited concern for our own well-being. So in this stage of the puja, it's sort of we're going with that and we're giving it to other beings, not just giving it away, you know, like to sort of lie on the floor, you know, giving up self and it just sort of lies there on the floor kind of... there's myself, I don't need it anymore, but just give it to beings. Yeah. So that's the whole territory of the Sevenfold Puja. This is the sort of map that we're going to be following over the next few weeks and sort of exploring each of these devotional moods or mental states, one arising out of the other. And hopefully, you know, to give when we do actually perform a Sevenfold Puja, hopefully imbuing it with more kind of this awareness and meaning and so forth. So, does anybody, we've got time for just a couple of questions. Anybody got anything they want to ask before we move on? It's fine if you don't, because we'll have plenty of time. What I'd like us to do is to actually, you know, repeat the first stage of the Sevenfold Puja, but I'm going to lead up to it with a reading. It's kind of embedded within the second chapter of the Bodhicharavatara, but there's more to it than the words that we usually use. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read a few more verses than usual, which create, I think, maybe a kind of fuller sense of the mood that's being invoked in the first stage of the puja, which I described of as that sort of offerings, making offerings, conjuring up the sense of the Buddha and making offerings. And in the Bodhicharavatara, what Shantideva does is he just conjures up offering after offering after offering after offering. And it's important to try and just imagine these. You know, he's conjuring up things in our imagination. All the sort of fruits and flowers and harvests and, you know, all sorts of things that we can imagine being conjured up. And then just being offered to what we most value, to our ideals. So I'll read that, and then we'll just move into the three verses which we normally chant in call and response. So you'll recognise those when they come. And then we'll finish by chanting the Avalokiteshvara mantra. Would you like to read that? Would you lead the Avalokiteshvara mantra? If you want to make offerings, feel free to do that. But I suggest that you don't sort of line up and come slowly. Just feel free to come forward, you know, and crowd around the shrine if you like. Don't feel you need to wait. And instead, if you want to make offerings of incense, don't leave them burning, or people who have asthma will choke. Read these few verses first. In order to bring about the arising of that precious jewel of the mind, the bodhicitta, I offer worship to the Buddhas and to the flawless jewel of the true Dharma and to the bodhisattvas who are oceans of virtue. I offer to them now as many flowers and fruit as there are in the world, as many healing herbs, as many jewels, and all waters clear and refreshing. I offer mountains made of precious stones and forest groves to be enjoyed in solitude, vines blazing with flowers, and trees whose branches bend low with delicious fruit. I offer fragrances of the celestial realms, the wishing tree with fruits of jewels, pools and lakes adorned with lotuses, and the endlessly fascinating cry of wild geese. I offer rich harvests, both wild and cultivated. I offer everything that can adorn those worthy of worship, and I offer everything which no one owns within the limitless spheres of space. Conjuring all these in my imagination, I offer them to the incomparable sages. O compassionate ones, you who are worthy of the choicest gifts, think kindly of me and accept these offerings of mine. With Mandarava, blue lotus and jasmine, with all flowers pleasing and fragrant,
with all flowers pleasing and fragrant,
and with garlands skillfully woven,
and with garlands skillfully woven,
I pay honour to the princes of the sages.
I pay honour to the princes of the sages,
so worthy of veneration.
So worthy of veneration.
I envelop them in clouds of incense.
I envelop them in clouds of incense.
Sweet and penetrating.
Sweet and penetrating.
I make them offerings of food hard and soft.
I make them offerings of food hard and soft.
And pleasing kinds of liquids to drink.
And pleasing kinds of liquids to drink.
I offer them lamps encrusted with jewels.
I offer them lamps encrusted with jewels,
festooned with golden lotus,
festooned with golden lotus,
on the paving sprinkled with perfume,
on the paving sprinkled with perfume.
I scatter handfuls of beautiful flowers.
I scatter handfuls of beautiful flowers.
Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Om Mani Padme Hum. Om
Om Mani Padme Hum.